So if you have followed me for any amount of time, you know my sagas with garden issues. And one of my big garden issues in years past has been the persistent herbicide contamination in my garden that happened many years ago. And that prompted a lot of things. But one of the biggest shifts from that experience was that we put in raised beds. And our raised beds are a little unorthodox, and the pictures of them have gone viral over the years and have prompted a lot of questions from many of you. Not only how I or how we made them, I didn't make them, my husband did, but how I garden them and if you should build ones like mine and all of those things. And so we've talked about raised beds here and there on the podcast over the years, but today we're going to do a definitive deep dive into this topic. And I think it's very timely considering we're rolling up into gardening season, or at least most of us are, many of us are. So I'm very excited to be joined by Scott Wilson. He is a master gardener from Colorado. More than 35 years of gardening experience. He has 20 years teaching gardening classes. And you may already know him because he's Gardener Scott on YouTube and has over 400,000 subscribers. Now, he knows all sorts of things in the gardening realm, but he is publishing, or he just published a book called Gardener Scott's Guide to Raised Bed Gardening. And so when I saw this email come into my inbox, I knew I wanted to have him on because we need someone to help us dive through this world of raised beds. Should you build them? How do you build them? How do you grow in them? What are the common pitfalls and all of that? So welcome, Scott. I'm super excited to have you.
Thanks, Jill. I'm excited to be here.
I was really excited to see you're in Colorado. We were talking a minute before we hit record. I've had a lot of gardener folks on the podcast, but it's always nice to have those that understand the uniqueness of growing out west. And I think you're even higher altitude than I am. So I would imagine that if you can do it, then anyone can.
Oh, exactly. I'm at 7,000 feet almost exactly in my garden. And I've gardened in Montana and California and Oklahoma. And Colorado is certainly a challenging region. Yes. This whole front range of the Rocky Mountains is one of the more challenging areas in the United States.
I agree. Yes. So you get it. You totally get it. Before I dive into the questions, because I have lots of questions, I'm excited for this. Give us kind of a picture. Paint us a picture of your gardens and, you know, your percentage of raised beds versus in ground, or your what your setup looks like.
So I'd garden on about half an acre here in Colorado, and I love raised beds. I became a master gardener just about 20 years ago and didn't really know much about raised beds before then. You know, I think, and I talk about this in my book, raised beds are a relatively new way to garden. And they're so effective and so efficient that now it seems like everybody on YouTube is growing in raised beds. But it didn't always look that way. Most gardens look like Mr. McGregor's garden in Peter Rabbit, with the nice flat furrows and little fence around it. And since then, we've all evolved, most of us, I think, in the gardening world. And so my garden is a lot of different types of raised beds. I've got wooden raised beds that are my primary vegetable garden space. I've got metal raised beds that I use for vegetables, but I also have some of my perennials, strawberries, asparagus, and those type of beds. I have stone raised beds. I have concrete block raised beds. And then I also do have in-ground beds. So my pollinator garden, for instance, is slightly elevated, but not quite what I would consider a raised bed. And that's where I'm growing my perennials and my annuals, and I've got fruit trees. And so I'm the kind of gardener that likes to have my hands in everything. And so I've got the perennials like rhubarb and asparagus, and I've got the annuals like cosmos and zinnias, and alphabetically everything in between.
That's fantastic. I love that you have all the materials.
Yeah. I think the wooden raised beds are ubiquitous. I mean, that's what many new gardeners tend to think is how you're supposed to garden in raised beds. Is you get some wooden boards and you hammer or screw them together, and the whole garden needs to look that way. Well, I established essentially a little over 10 years ago a school garden here in Colorado Springs. And we had 105 raised beds. And because we were growing food for the school district and because it was an educational garden for the students, all the beds were exactly the same. And yes, it was 105 4-foot by 8-foot wooden raised beds. And I think people see that and expect that that's what you're supposed to do. But I remember one person in particular commenting about how it looked like a row of coffins in this bare ground. And that really got me thinking about how raised beds could be much more than that. And that was really the catalyst for me to start thinking about a future book at the time, but also to start experimenting with the metal beds and the stone beds and the concrete beds and beds that are, instead of wooden lumber, are logs that are stacked to form the sides. There's just really no limit in the types of beds that you can create and still call them raised beds.
I think that it's really easy, especially when people see photos online, and I'm partially guilty of that because my husband tends to over-engineer, and he built some bridge decking steel beds that are beautiful, and they look neat, you know, in a big line, and they're shiny and stuff. But I think people do think it has to be this uniform, perfectly aesthetic, laid out situation. And I love the idea where, like you said, you can kind of mix and match, you use materials you have. I think there's something special about that that almost mimics nature a little bit more, that just kind of lets it be what it wants to be.
Oh, exactly. And I like to work with nature. So I'm glad you said that. You know, I think too many gardeners battle against the pests and the diseases and the weather. And I've learned over the years that if you just allow Mother Nature to essentially fix the problems by giving your garden the opportunity to attract the beneficial insect predators and the animals and all of those things that are going to make your garden healthier, then it makes the whole environment so much easier and so much more enjoyable. And so when it comes to raised beds in particular, I use those materials that are around me. So when we put in something like a low raised bed made out of logs or even a mounded bed, I have a hugelkultur mound that elevates the bed about 15 to 18 inches above the ground. There's no borders to it. It's open to all the animals and all the insects. And it's one of my healthiest beds because I'm not confining the plants and the soil. I'm allowing it all to work together and really create what I call an equilibrium within the garden, where all of the soil microbes are there to benefit the plants. And then, of course, you know, I have some artificial methods for the cold weather we have here on the east side of the Rockies. But all in all, I try to make it as easy as possible. And the design of the bed is really the foundation of that.
You're speaking my language. I love that. I want to get more into the soil and all of those strategies here in a minute. But just to kind of paint the picture for people listening, let's say they're tuning into this episode. They've been intrigued by raised beds. They're not sure if they want to commit the time and the energy, the finances to building them. Can you kind of walk someone through the thought process to answer the question, are raised beds right for me?
Oh, sure. And I do recognize that they aren't necessarily the best choice for all gardeners in all situations. But the first thought, I always recommend starting small. If you're considering a raised bed, rather than designing an entire garden based on raised beds, or rather than converting an existing garden to raised beds, try one or two in the first year. And I have yet to meet someone that doesn't try one and then decide they need to have more, because it becomes one of those things you recognize the benefits. But you have to ask yourself why you are gardening and what plants you are going to grow. And that's one of the first steps when deciding if raised beds are an appropriate option for you. Now, here in my part of Colorado, the soil is terrible. I have less than 1% organic matter. The nutrient levels are essentially zero. And so to grow a vegetable garden in that kind of soil, it is wasted effort. And yes, we can amend that soil, but amending soil takes time for the soil microbes, the populations to grow, the nutrients to be available to the plants. And that's one of the biggest benefits of raised beds, is that you can build a raised bed and immediately fill it with good soil, either purchase soil or soil that you create from a recipe. And I cover a lot of that in my book, to include recipes for how to build different types of soil. And so by starting with just one or two beds and filling it with a good soil, if that's one of your issues, then you can begin gardening right away. If you have clay soil, it's the same kind of issue. Or if you have sandy soil, if the soil is the problem, a raised bed is often an easy solution to that. And it doesn't need to be anything fancy. That's why so many people just hammer a couple boards together and then fill it with good soil. It's important to recognize that the raised bed itself is not magical. A raised bed is not going to fix your problems unless you've taken the time to figure out what gardening issues you have and then make the fixes that are necessary. Typically, it relates to soil. And then take the raised beds to the next level to start growing.
Great advice. Yes. And that brings me to my next question, which is a big one. And I've had so many people reach out and build raised beds, and they're like, how do I fill it? Because they go to the garden store, buy a few bags of potting soil, and realize they dump it in there and it barely makes a dent in filling the bed. What's your best strategies for if you are building more than one? Let's say you're building a substantial amount. How do you find the good soil or create that soil to fill the beds and not cost yourself millions of dollars?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. In fact, my best performing video on YouTube with more than 4.5 million views is how to fill a raised bed.
I bet.
Yeah. And it is. It's a very common issue. It's a very common concern. And I address it in that video as well as the book, that if you fill your raised bed completely with purchased materials, it can be very expensive, as you alluded to. And so depending on the size of the bed, and when I talk about size, it's more the height of the bed. It allows you a lot of options. So most of my beds sit about 16 inches high. One of the advantages for me, you know, those of us, we get to a certain age and we start having back issues, and I find it so much easier to just sit on the side of my raised bed and do a lot of the general tasks. And so the 16 inches that I have of soil in my raised bed, it's not all high quality materials. The plants that we grow are dependent on a certain depth of soil. And so for most of the plants we're growing in our vegetable garden, about 8 inches of soil is adequate. Some need a little bit more, some need a little bit less. But for a bed that's 16 inches high, I only need the top half to really be good soil. So the bottom half I fill with logs and sticks and leaves and wood chips and some of my own native soil, which is terrible. Mm-hmm. And over time, that woody material will break down. It will attract a fungal network that can actually benefit the soil. And then, of course, that mixes with my native soil and improves the native soil. And so that is a bottom structure that essentially costs nothing. If you have access to tree branches and you can dig up some soil. And then the top half, I'll still use some of my native soil. Again, low cost, I just dig it up from a corner of my yard, and then I start mixing in the organic matter. And that organic matter can be purchased, it can be what you have on hand. I like to use dried grass clippings, shredded leaves, and whatever I have as kitchen scraps to actually create some of that organic matter when I'm first filling a bed. And if you're making your own compost, of course, that's an ideal solution to adding organic matter to the soil. But if you don't want to take all that effort to create compost and to collect whatever it is you have on your landscape, sure, at that point, you can purchase bagged compost and bagged organic materials to put into your bed. For a large quantity, and this is the approach that I've taken when I do multiple beds, is to order soil in bulk. Actually order soil that already has the compost in it. Maybe it has a humus mix into it. And you can begin filling your beds with that material, but you don't have to fill the whole bed, just that portion where the roots are going to be growing.
I love that idea. And you were talking about putting the logs and the wood in the bottom. That's almost a little bit of a hugelkultur concept.
Exactly.
Combined in, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It is the hugelkultur. And for those listeners who don't know what the hugelkultur is, it's basically a concept where you dig a trench and you fill the trench with logs and you stack the logs and the branches until it becomes a high mound. And then you add compost and soil on top of all of that wood and you plant in that. And as the wood decomposes, it helps to enrich the soil. Well, I've modified that to basically turn it upside down and put the bed in place. And then the logs are at the base of the bed, accomplishing the same thing. It's a free filler. Yeah. But as the logs decompose over time, it creates a wonderful foundation for good soil throughout the bed, because the earthworms and arthropods and all the other soil organisms are going to be moving the nutrients and that organic matter throughout the soil.
I love that. Yeah, I love that. Hey, friends, so I'm interrupting this episode for just a second to talk about something that I actually used to be really embarrassed about, so much so that I never talked about it publicly. And that is the fact that every summer, I would basically completely fall out of love with cooking. So much so that I just didn't want to do it anymore. And I was thinking that I was the only one who felt like that until recently, when I started to share my deep, dark secret online. And I found out that many, many of you feel the same way. I think it's just because we have so much going on in the summers that it's just really hard to find that motivation to get in the kitchen and put food on the table. The problem is, our people, well, they still want to eat. Unfortunately. So we still have to find ways to nourish them and ourselves in a cost-effective and healthy way. So I've been wrestling with this problem in my own life and, you know, for those of you, for many years now, trying different things, experimenting with different ideas. And I finally have created something that I think may just help. I know it has helped me. It's called MealCraft, and it's not your typical meal planning system. Rather, it's a set of customizable frameworks that are endlessly flexible based on what you have in your gardens, your pantries, your freezers, your larders. You don't have to go to the grocery store to do specific shopping trips or anything like that. We're just using what you have, which really is what homesteading is all about. So MealCraft gives you 4 new frameworks each month, and I'm personally having so much fun with these because they can be different every time, saves me a lot of money. It's reducing the leftovers and the waste that's coming out of my kitchen, and it just makes it a lot more enjoyable. So if you'd like to join us over in MealCraft, over 600 of you have already joined the fun. You can visit the link in the show notes to learn more. Now, back to our episode. Okay, so we filled our beds. Let's say we've grown for a year or two. I think another really big sticking point for folks is, how do we replenish the nutrients in those beds? Because I know that, I've dealt with, you know, I test the soil, I see the declining nitrogen, I'm working on adding things, but just feels like it's a little more responsibility on us, the gardener, to make sure that the nutrients are there. So how do you keep that soil refreshed and healthy?
Yeah, that's a good question. And that's an important step, you know, and again, just filling the raised bed once is not enough. You do need to replenish the soil. And what you're really doing is you're adding more food for the soil microbes. And that food is in the source of organic matter. And so I recommend doing this in the fall. And it is to take all those things I had mentioned, the dried grass clippings, the crushed leaves, the manure that you might have access to, the compost, all of those organic materials are worked into the soil, amending the soil in fall. And the reason I think it's more important to do it in fall than most other times of the year is because it takes a while. We're talking the bacteria, microscopic organisms that now need to feed on this material. And there are other organisms that are feeding on those organisms, all the part of the soil food web. And that takes time. Even if you have a huge population, and you will have billions and billions of these microbes in your soil, you're going to have chunky material that takes longer to break down. If you can do that in the fall and you're planting in spring, for some of us, very late spring, you now give months for those microbes and soil organisms to break down that material. And when they break down that material, that's what releases the nutrients into the soil. So if you've got a deficiency in any of the six macronutrients or the many micronutrients that plants need, it all can come from the organic matter that is decomposed and then released back into the soil. And by doing that regularly, you don't have to do it every year. And this is another magical part of soil, is only 3 or 4 years of amending your soil, you can achieve some amazing levels of nutrients and take off a couple years without having to do amending again. And if you kind of get in that cycle about 3 years on and 1 or 2 years off, you'll be able to sustain good soil for the life of your garden.
Yes, definitely. So I'm curious, this brings up another question. Are you turning your raised bed soil over? Or are you just trying to layer it and kind of keep that no-till effect?
So a little bit of both. So in the beginning, the organic matter needs to be incorporated into the soil, particularly if you do like I do, where you're starting with the native soil, which has no nutrition in it. So you need to incorporate the organic matter throughout the soil. Even when you purchase a soil that already has the blend, it's important to incorporate more organic matter into that mix over the first couple years. But once you've reached that 3 or 4 year point and you have a pretty healthy soil, then yes, I think you can go to the no dig. And that's what I do. And so the no dig method essentially is just adding a couple inches of compost on top of the soil. It will release its nutrients down through rainfall and through normal watering practices. And then those organisms that are active in the soil will also begin feeding closer to the surface because they've got that food source on top.
Do you find with those beds that you've been, you know, amending for 3 to 4 years, you've really nurtured them, are you able to plant in the spring? Like, you don't have to cultivate at all? You just are able to put your seeds in?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
One of the nice things, and this is, you know, a big reason why I like the raised beds, is you're able to keep all of this soil contained and within the space, within the confines of the raised bed. And there is essentially no compaction. People aren't walking across the garden. You're not using a pathway 1 year and turning it into a garden bed the next year. And so, except for the weight of snow that we have here in Colorado, mm-hmm. the soil stays relatively loose, particularly with all that organic matter and without any compaction. And I also recommend mulch. So I'll always have my beds mulched, typically with straw. Here in Colorado, you probably see this as well with our high winds. I find that a mix of straw and leaves and grass tends to stay put and not blow away as readily. And so that also reduces compaction and makes it so when the spring arrives, the soil is ready to go. And I just put a hole in a seed or a little furrow and a row of seeds. And it makes for very easy planting.
I love that. Yes. I have some of my beds up to that point. I have others when I filled them initially, it wasn't as knowledgeable, wasn't paying attention. And I got a lot of clay in there. So it's been many years of cover crops and mulch. And I still feel like I have to dig them in the spring just to be able to get into the soil. But I'm hoping we'll get to that point eventually where it's a lot easier just to plant and go.
And it does depend on the plant. So, you know, for instance, the garlic, I typically will devote a bed to garlic. Mm-hmm. And so I'll try to amend the bed like in late summer. So I'll be clearing out one crop, amending it, then putting my garlic in place. And the garlic is going to stay in the ground until I'm harvesting it in summer. So that cycle can be adjusted depending on what kind of crops you're growing. And if you're growing something over the course of the winter and harvesting it in spring, yes, you can also amend in spring and modify it. But But over time, what you'll find is you can do less and less of that spring amending or that summer amending. And I just like to keep gardening as easy as possible. And that's one way to do it.
Oh, back on your fall, when you add your amendments in the fall, on your existing beds, are you digging those in the fall? I know you said initially you have to dig them in. Are you usually doing that in the fall as you put the organic matter on?
Yeah. So those first couple years, I'm turning the organic matter into the soil as amendments. Beyond that point, when we start getting to year 5 and 6 and 7, it's generally just adding compost on top of the soil at that point. I'm not always turning it in, but I'm close to my soil and close to my plants on a daily basis to see how it is. And so when it comes time to think about planting, I go out and I check my soil. I stick my fingers in it to see if it's loose. I dig up a trowelful or two to see what the quality looks like. And if for some reason it doesn't look like it's as good as I would like it to be, then I'll amend with some compost in spring. And I try to do that early because, again, the time component is important. And so I'll do all of that in early spring as soon as I can work the soil so that if I do need to add compost in spring, I have at least a month or two before I'm actually putting the plants in the ground.
Okay. I like that. Makes sense. Okay. Talk to me about water and how you handle that. I know there's also the concern with some folks that live in really warm climates that raised beds dry out more quickly than an in-ground bed. So what would your advice be to them? And also, I'd love to hear your watering setup for what you have now.
So yes, that is true, basically, that a raised bed will dry out faster. It's exposed to more wind. The sides of the bed lead to potential drying of the edges. And so the whole bed does tend to dry out a little bit faster. But I think that can be mitigated by that introduction of organic matter. And so raised bed generally, I think, tends to have more organic matter in it than a lot of in-ground beds. And so that's one way to hold the water into the bed so that it doesn't drain out as quickly. And then the mulch, of course, is a critical factor because the surface of the soil is where we're going to lose most of that moisture through evaporation. So the organic matter in the soil and the mulch helps reduce that issue where a raised bed will dry out faster. There are a number of ways to do it. Now, here in my part of Colorado, where all of the water is charged, it's not free, and I try to reduce the amount of water that I use, I do not advocate overhead sprinkling. And so a lot of gardeners in an open bed area will put their sprinklers on and cover the whole area equally. Different plants have different water needs. And so within my raised beds, I group my plants when I sow the seeds or when I plant so that all of the plants within a bed have basically the same water needs. And so overhead watering when I garden like that means some beds would be getting more water than they need. Other beds would be getting less water than they need. And then, of course, I'm watering the pathways, and the pathways don't need water, and the sides of the beds don't need water. So I focus my watering to each bed individually. My personal preferred method is hand watering. I can see pests if they happen to arrive and deal with them immediately. I can recognize disease that might appear and deal with it immediately because I'm up and close and personal with my plants on a daily basis. I'm checking the soil every day, and I'm giving the plants the water they need, not on a schedule, but based on my own analysis and recognition based on the experience, of course. But I have time to do that, and I love doing that. Another option that I encourage is soaker hoses or drip irrigation. It's a little more challenging in raised beds because you need the lines running from bed to bed and from the water source, and then they have to go up into the bed. It can be done. What I tend to do when I have the drip irrigation in my vegetable garden beds is I will set up the drip irrigation for particular plants. So for instance, if I'm growing squash plants in a bed, and I might be growing 8 or 10 squash plants in my raised bed, I'll have the central line for the drip irrigation, then I'll have the emitters going out to each plant. And I keep that as a single unit. So at the end of the season, when I remove that hose from that bed and put it into my shed, the next year, either in that same bed or a different bed, if I choose to grow squash, I just pull out that already configured drip system, plop it into the new bed, and it's all ready to go. So that's one way to make it a little bit easier. And then, of course, the timing. I'm not a huge fan of setting a timer and watering the same amount every single day, but I recognize that many gardeners with jobs and family responsibilities sometimes have to take that on and just try to let the garden become as automatic as possible. But they still need to get out on a regular basis to check the soil and see if it's becoming saturated, if it's too dry. Particularly over the course of the summer, you need to modify your watering plan. And the amount of water we put into our soil in spring is going to be less than what we need to put into our soil in summer when it's hot and when the plants are actively growing. So I know it's a longer answer to your question, but the point is that it's very flexible. There's a lot that needs to be thought about with the watering. It's not as simple as just put a hose in place and turn the timer on and expect that that's going to work throughout the entire season.
I agree. Mm-hmm. Yes. I do have timed, my husband, again, he likes to over engineer. So he has this whole time system, but that's the biggest downfall to that system. It's nice when I go on vacation, which is not very often, but when I do leave, it's nice. But like you said, if it's not set and forget, because it will overwater, it underwaters, it rains, it just, there is a lot more to it and just watching it. What's that quote? I'm going to butcher it. The best fertilizer is the gardener's touch or something like that. The gardener's footstep. It's so true. Just being out there, putting your hands on plants, looking at them regularly is just, it's really the magic, the secret sauce, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that's one of my key philosophies. And I say a good garden grows where a good gardener goes. And the idea is that just by being in your garden, you will see things and you will correct things, just second nature. You don't even think about it. And then, of course, when it comes to the focus on the watering or the amending or whatever it happens to be, it's not magic. It's just you in your garden doing what needs to happen. And then you look back and wonder why it's so easy.
Yeah. Yes. Little bits every day. Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious. I think you would say you probably most anything could grow in a raised bed. I know you're growing a ton of different things in a ton of different styles of raised beds, but I'm curious if there's anything you would recommend people just don't grow in a raised bed that just doesn't thrive in that situation.
Well, now we get back to the basic idea of what a raised bed is, the purpose for the raised bed, and then the composition, the materials that make up the raised bed. So one of the biggest problems I see, and I actually took some pictures of my front yard when I moved into this house to put it into the book, and someone had made a raised bed out of concrete blocks. And it was a relatively small bed. And then they planted a big tree in the middle of it. Now, at the time, it wasn't a big tree, I'm sure. But over time, the roots and the trunk have just demolished that bed so that the whole area is broken and unsightly. And so those kind of things, if you just think that this little raised bed is enough to contain your plants, you really need to think about the type of plants you're growing. Now, trees can do great in raised beds. If you go to like the Denver Botanic Garden, for instance, there are a number of beautiful raised beds that are growing huge trees, but they're big raised beds and they're stone raised beds so that the edges don't need to be replaced over time and they're holding in all the massive amounts of soil. And so as we scale the size of our beds to the plants, now you can modify the bed appropriately. And in the garden, a wooden raised bed might be suitable for our carrots and our tomatoes and our peppers and essentially anything you grow in your vegetable garden, you can grow in a raised bed. But if you want to have a perennial garden, or I've got a lot of fruit bushes, plants that are going to be there for a while, you don't want to have to think about the possibility that in time that wood is going to rot and it's going to need to be replaced. So you can still do a raised bed in perennial areas. You just need to think about doing it in steel or stone or concrete so that you're not going to disrupt the plants if you ever have to replace any of the components that make up that raised bed. But the plants, I mean, there are some plants that are just so obviously suited for raised beds, like mint, for instance, all those plants that become invasive. I've got my horseradish in a metal raised bed, the kind of bed that the plant can't escape from. And so that's a consideration as well, as far as what not to put in a raised bed. I would not put invasive plants into a raised bed unless it had tall enough sides and potentially even a bottom to keep those plants from escaping.
Because mint will, it will escape. It is.
Oh, yeah.
It's something. So, okay. That's great advice. I'm curious, kind of to circle back on what we were talking about building, we're talking about wood beds and, having to replace those. Let's say someone's listening to this right now and they're feeling inspired. I love your advice of just starting with one raised bed. You don't have to go build 20 off the bat. If you're just going to build one raised bed and you had to use free or scavenged materials, what would you do for that?
I would say do it. And it is relatively easy to find, on Facebook Marketplace or any of the other wonderful places that people can find stuff for free or very low cost and get some reclaimed lumber. It doesn't need to look pretty. And that's one of the things about learning how to garden in raised beds. I started with very basic, some would say halfway ugly beds, just to learn how to do it. And now I've got beautiful beds because over time I recognize that you can make the raised bed part of the beauty within your garden. That, some of those metal raised bed kits that they have now, you can order in many different colors. So you can bring color to your garden by having a metal raised bed, or you can choose a different type of stone color for the raised bed to really make a visual statement. But in the beginning, just hammer a couple boards together and fill it with soil. If you're lucky enough to live in a region where the soil is already good, you don't have to worry so much about the amending. You can just dig it up and put it into the bed. A friend of mine who lives in Wales in the UK makes raised beds like that, where he just digs up the soil in the pathways to fill his raised beds because he's got naturally good soil in the area. And so it can be as simple as that, just a basic framework to identify where the bed is and then just put soil in it. And it can cost nothing in the very beginning.
I think that's great advice because I think people do get really intimidated by the cost. Like you go price out redwood at the Home Depot and it's like, oh my gosh, this is just can't work. So I think the reclaimed lumber is good. Do you avoid treated lumber? I'm assuming, is there any things to really stay away from? Railroad ties, are you keeping away from anything with those chemicals in it? Or do you have a concern there?
So I really don't. And I have gardened in both. So Oregon State University released a study last year that showed pressure treated wood has absolutely no impact in a vegetable garden.
Oh, okay.
And I was actually part of that study. They contacted me because in my videos, you can see that I have all these different types of beds. And I actually took soil samples from my beds that are that have treated wood. I have beds with untreated wood. I have beds with the concrete and the metal, all of that, of course. And as part of their study, I sent samples from all of my beds to Oregon State University, and along with many other methods that they use to test soils. And it's not a problem. Pressure-treated wood today is not the same pressure-treated wood of 20 years ago that really did pose some problems. Now, as far as the railroad ties, I have used railroad ties. The creosote within the railroad ties is a carcinogen. Some states like California label it as a carcinogen. And so I caution using those in a bed that you're going to be actively working in. And it's not so much an issue that it's going to harm the plants, because if the creosote is still active, it's going to kill the plant before a plant's going to uptake any of those chemicals. It's more a concern of you working with those treated woods, those railroad ties with bare skin, and okay. some of those chemical treatments might get onto your skin. That's really the biggest issue. And so I use old railroad ties where most of the creosote is already leached out, and I use it more as just a framing border of a large area, not to actually make the individual beds. And then over time, that will continue to break down. And you'll see that in a lot of different areas, particularly municipal areas, where they use railroad ties to frame a raised bed along a sidewalk, because it's going to last for years and years and years. And those beds are filled with flowers and filled with bushes in that type of setting. So it really isn't an issue. It's just, I always wear my leather gloves anytime I work with materials like that.
But that's fascinating about the OSU study. I have always heard people, they were so nervous about that online. I get so many questions. So that's reassuring that, you know, potentially it's not something when you have to worry about it as much. Use your gloves when you're building it. And yeah, that's reassuring for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, if you really delve deep into the findings, it's almost beneficial. There is a very small amount of copper that is released directly next to the wood, because copper is the main component of the chemicals that are used in the pressure treatment these days. But copper is an element that the plants need. So, you know, if your soil happens to be deficient in copper, and most soils aren't, you can actually be introducing a very small amount of copper directly next to the wood. And theoretically, it could almost benefit your soil.
That's awesome. Okay. Wow. I did not know that. So that's way cool. What is your absolute favorite thing to grow in a raised bed? I'm sure that might be a hard question, but do you have like the thing that you think is like the perfect raised bed plant?
Well, the thing that I love growing, and I think it really is an ideal plant for raised beds, is tomatoes.
I was going to say tomatoes. Yeah.
And so one of the advantages to raised beds that I think a lot of people don't realize until they start working with raised beds, particularly if we're talking the vegetable garden and you've got that rectangular bed that's 4 feet by 8 foot deep. You know, a lot of people are familiar with square foot gardening by Mel Bartholomew, and you establish a grid system for your plantings. Raised beds are ideal, and I'm sure your husband likes this aspect, because you can lay out the grid and you can plan exactly where every seed is going to go to maximize the production within your growing space. And so I can put in easily 8 tomato plants within my 4 foot by 8 foot raised beds. And then also I can grow plants like basil next to the tomatoes, and I'll even put peppers into the same bed. So I really maximize my space. I grow vertically, so I have trellises so that the tomato plants are growing up. And the nice thing about the raised bed, particularly with a plant like tomatoes, you don't need to bend over really to harvest. You just walk up to the bed, and as the plant is growing, you're just reaching through the trellis into the plant and harvesting it, and it makes the whole process so much easier. And because the soil is so critical for so many plants we grow, but particularly tomatoes, it's about the easiest way to grow a plant. And I just love the fresh tomatoes from the garden. So of course, that's always at the top of my list.
Yes, I agree. I do love growing them. It feels easier to keep them organized. I think that in raised beds in general, like, it's not the number one reason I would use them, but I do love the fact that it just feels easier to manage and keep things in little compartments and organized. And I love that aspect of it for some reason.
Oh, no, I totally agree. Yeah, you know, I, you know, like I mentioned earlier, you know, I have my bed for garlic, and I have my bed for squash, and I have my bed for tomatoes, and I have my bed for peppers. Now, I will add other plants, like, for instance, my salad bed. So I'll be growing spinach and lettuce and beets and carrots and radishes all within the same bed, but it is very nice and orderly where they're either in blocks or they're in rows. And I like to practice succession planting. So when I'm harvesting a lettuce, then I'm planting a lettuce and keeping that bed going for as long as I can. And the same holds true with all the other plants in the garden. Raised beds, especially if you're a math geek and you like to lay out a grid, it can keep things in such good order that you will be a happy gardener.
Yeah, it feels good. The OCD part of my brain likes it. Well, we've covered a lot of ground. You answered a lot of my personal questions, so thank you for that. Is there anything we missed? Any advice you want to share with folks listening to this who are contemplating raised beds, considering it this year? Anything we didn't cover?
Yeah, a big advantage to raised beds that I think people also don't take as much advantage of is that they are ideal. If you've got pest problems in particular, and all kinds of pests. And so I have rabbits in my backyard, and I've got gophers in my backyard, and I've got voles in my backyard. And like I said at the beginning, I like to work with nature. So I'm not poisoning, I'm not trapping. The raised bed is a deterrent. Just the height of the bed is a deterrent for the voles and the gophers and the rabbits. Now, at the bottom of the bed, I do put hardware cloth so that the burrowing animals can't burrow into the bed from below. But the height means they're not going to climb into the bed. They could, but I'm not eradicating all of the weeds that are growing around the edges of my garden, because what some people might consider a weed are really native plants, native grasses, native weedy leafy plants, and that's the food for the rabbits and a lot of these animals. So the raised bed is kind of a trouble spot for them. They can stay outside the bed and have all the food they want around the edges of my garden. As soon as they climb into the raised bed, they now become potential prey to the hawks and the owls and the cats that I have in my garden as well. So as a pest deterrent for those kind of pests, raised beds can be great. I have hoops that I keep in my raised beds almost year round. I use cattle panel that I bend into the hoops that I put into the beds. And so they are perfectly sized to my beds. When it comes to protecting the plants from the weather, those hoops in those beds make it extremely easy. So in early spring, I can throw a sheet of plastic and keep the soil nice and warm. In the summer, when it's so hot, I can cover the hoops with shade cloth to help keep my plants a little bit cool. And when it's thunderstorm season, I could put hail cloth over the hoops.
Just hail, yeah.
Exactly. And so all of this is all pre-sized. So I have the hoops pre-sized to fit my beds. I have all of those materials pre-sized to fit my beds. And so if I see a hailstorm coming, I could just go to my shed, pull out the pre-cut piece, throw it onto the hoops, and then put some spring clamps in place and not have to worry as much about the weather. And I've got a deer problem as well. So putting those hoops over the beds also helps keep the deer from sticking their nose in and eating the plants. And I don't have a big problem with insect pests because my garden is in equilibrium. But you could put a nice insect fabric over the beds to keep the pests out for those young seedlings. So that's a big aspect that I think people really don't take advantage of when we talk about the raised beds, is analyzing the problem you have, and you'll be able to probably find a solution by putting a raised bed in.
I mean, you're right. I hadn't really thought of that protective aspect as much. And that's brilliant. Just with all those different pieces you mentioned, that's a huge advantage for a lot of folks dealing with a lot of those issues.
Exactly. And it, you know, there's that initial effort, you know, to make the hoops, to cut the pieces. But, you know, again, if you do a little bit of work in the beginning, it becomes so much easier in the end. You don't have to worry about dealing with a pest because you don't have a pest.
Exactly. Yeah. I love that. That's brilliant. Well, this has been amazing. You are a wealth of information. I want to encourage everyone listening, please go watch Scott's YouTube channel. He has so much good stuff over there. He just is a great teacher, a great mentor. And don't forget to check out his book, Gardener Scott's Guide to Raised Bed Gardening. And that's everywhere books are sold, right? Amazon, all the places.
That's right. Yeah, it's available for order. You can go to your local bookstore and order. You can go to your library and ask for it, and they can order it. Anywhere that you would get books nowadays online, you can order it.
Okay. And are you on social media anywhere?
Yeah, I'm Gardener Scott everywhere. So I'm Gardener Scott on Instagram. I'm Gardener Scott on X. I'm Instagram on Blue Sky. I'm Gardener Scott everywhere. I'm not active necessarily everywhere. I tend to do most of my focus on YouTube with a little bit of Instagram that shows kind of behind the scenes stuff in my garden.
Awesome. Well, thank you again. I'm feeling extra inspired. I'm getting ready to start seedlings. And so now I'm just feeling a little extra antsy thanks to this conversation. So I appreciate that.
Oh, you're welcome, Jill. I appreciate you having me on the show. I enjoyed it.